Moto Casino, American Social Casino.
Welcome to Moto Casino, where the excitement never ends, with thousands of the hottest free-to-play social casino games, fastest payouts, and the best promotions in the industry. No tricks or gimmicks. Owned and operated in the USA.
Moto Casino is a free-to-play social casino. No purchase necessary. 21 plus to play. Void where prohibited.
Sign up today for a generous welcome bonus.
Moto Casino, American Social Casino.
Download the Moto Casino app today.
Chilling tales for dark nights.
The following program is a production of Chilling Entertainment and the creative team at Chilling Tales for Dark Nights, and a proud member of the Simply Scary Podcast Network. Visit simplyscarypodcast.com to learn more about this and our other weekly storytelling programs, and become a patron today to show your support and get instant access to our extensive archive of downloadable tales of terror. Thank you for listening, and enjoy the show. Disclaimer. Horror Hill is a horror anthology podcast bringing you scary stories from all corners of the internet and beyond. As such, certain stories include content that some listeners might find offensive. Listener discretion is advised. Hello there, listeners, and welcome back to Horror Hill. As always, I'm Eric Peabody, your host and narrator. First, I'd like to address the slight delay in episodes over the last few weeks. Unfortunately, one of our production team members had a family issue arise that deservedly required their attention. Things should be back on track now or soon, and we all appreciate your patience in the meantime. But that aside, today we leave behind our Lovecraft love fest of the past few weeks and jump back into the wider world of modern horror, with a tale by Jason Fisher, whom you might remember from Season 13, Episode 9 this past summer. The story tonight is titled Tendencies. And folks, I really enjoyed this one. After all, haven't we all wondered what we would do if we were omniscient, or even partly so? That's the situation our young, unnamed narrator finds themselves in after repairing a broken radio. Suddenly, whenever the tunes are playing, it's like he's there in the room with it, seeing without being seen. How might such a skill be used? And how might it change the person who wields that power? You're listening to the free edition of this program. If you'd like to help support Horror Hill and also remove these pesky ads, head to chillingtalesfordarknights.com and click Patrons in the upper menu to sign up today. You'll get instant access to hundreds of ad-free stories, so what are you waiting for? Also, if you're watching on YouTube, please do us a favor and drop a like and subscribe. Become part of our dark circle, listeners. And now, from author Jason Fisher, I give you Tendencies. Being as close to death as many times as I have, at least indirectly, I'm pretty surprised that I never really questioned what happens after someone's time's up. I guess this all started in the audiovisual club during my first year of high school. Those were the days long before therapists, shrinks, and counselors would use terms like sociopathic tendencies and other descriptions that I had to look up. Back then, I was always better with equipment than words. Or people, for that matter. That was before I developed my gift of gab, as my grandma used to call it. She was a mean old bat, but she was always good with quips like that. Anyway, I taught myself how to fix pretty much anything that had a tube or speakers when I was pretty young. Saying I taught myself is a bit of a lie, but you'll understand soon enough. The first time I discovered my special ability was when I was messing with Bill Humphrey's transistor radio when I was only 8. He had been by to make out with my sister for their regular Wednesday night romp. They were afforded an empty house, except for me, thanks to my parents' weekly date night. As usual, when my sister's overgrown suitor arrived, they went straight upstairs. And every time, right after he got there, Harriet warned me that she would beat me within an inch of my life if I followed them. My sister, although having a very pretty face, was no small girl, so I always took those warnings seriously. On that night, Bill left his leather jacket. He really had no business calling it leather anymore. It had more cloth patches than leather, yet he carried on like it was made of gold. On top of my chair fort, crushing the sheet I used as a canopy. Pissed, not a word an 8-year-old would use, I know. I grabbed the stinking patchwork, trying to reassemble my makeshift teepee, and his handheld radio slipped from the pocket, nearly landing square on my bare toes. Always agile, I hopped away at the last second, leaving it to fall on the floor. The faceplate with the station numbers went shooting into the baseboard, leaving the carcass behind to bleed wire guts. Knowing I was going to get it if they heard anything, I grabbed the pieces and ducked into the deformed fort. As I sat there, holding my breath and listening for footsteps on the old wooden stairs, I had what believers might call an epiphany. In my stubby, filthy fingers, I could feel the radio talking to me. It wasn't like you would think. It didn't use words. It vibrated. Each pulse ran up my arms, and somehow my flesh gave the vibrations words. Not the sort of words I was used to hearing. Instead, it communicated with pictures in my head. As I sat there, I felt vibrations through my entire body and saw images playing like a TV show. Step by step, I watched myself putting the radio back together. It didn't float around like a ghost. It was more like there was a camera inside my skull, taping. I could see my arms, body, and hands working, but not my face. It was weird because the images came while my eyes were open, so the radio surgery was happening over everything else I could see. After it stopped, I went into the tool drawer in my parents' kitchen and, within minutes, had the plastic radio back together. Telling the story now, I can only guess that anybody would have a hard time understanding how easy it was for me to accept what had happened. But at the time, my 8-year-old mind thought nothing of the event. It seemed perfectly normal that this knowledge would be made available like that. Anyway, feeling like I'd dodged a solid beating, I put the radio back in the jacket, and, as painful as it was, I put it back on top of my beautiful fort, crushing it again. A week later, it was date night again. Harriet had over a new beau whom I'd never seen before. He was a scrawny dude with slicked back hair. After the prerequisite beating threat, I was alone once again, sitting under the kitchen table. At that age, I had a thing for hiding places. As I sat there, the vibration I'd felt from the radio was back, like a tiny electric current running through my veins. It wasn't a bad feeling, but it wasn't good either. It was just a solid feeling, kind of like when you're in the shower waiting for the temperature to get just right. Anyway, a few seconds later, I heard music as if I were wearing headphones, and then suddenly I could see inside Bill Humphrey's car. I didn't know it was his car right away because, at first, I only saw two people hugging together in the back seat. Suddenly, large, hairy fingers almost completely obscured my view. As they rolled the dial, I heard new wave music coming through the single car speaker. Looking across my living room, I saw the new image kind of floating in the air over my dad's bookcase, which was filled with the spaceship models that he was so obsessed with. When Bill backed off, I saw a girl who was much shapelier than Harriet in the right kind of way. That explained the new scrawny creep upstairs. For the next few minutes, I watched Bill try to romance the pretty girl. That was a joke. He would have been better off sticking with his normal Wednesday thing, even if my sister wasn't in that girl's class. Again, I know there will be doubters out there who won't believe that I didn't freak out, but Honestly, and maybe it shows my stupidity, but I thought nothing of it. If I'm forced to explain it, and a-hole shrinks have asked me more times than I can count, it was because I didn't have anyone who gave a damn. My parents weren't bad people. They never beat us too badly or deprived us of anything reasonable. Many have told me that not giving love to a child is abuse. But the way I look at it, I couldn't yearn for something that I didn't know existed. Whenever I said that to any therapist, the notepad always came out and a flourish of notes went down. In those moments, I imagined what they had written. My usual guess was, "This one's a Freudian mess. No love. How could he ever get through that?" But honestly, I wasn't that bad off, regardless of what the head doctors wanted to say. There were many worse people who could have raised us. As I learned in the coming months, the connection to the radio was not temporary. Every Wednesday night at 8, if the radio was on, it took me far too long to figure that part out. I could see what was in front of it. The viewings became part of my life, the same as going to school or cutting the lawn. I didn't particularly look forward to them because I never knew what I would stare at, and believe me, watching Bill dancing and lip-syncing in the bathroom in only his underwear was no treat. The next viewing moment came when I was 10. By chance, my parents came across a used Atari console for a couple of bucks and gave it to me for my birthday. That summer, I used up my entire allowance buying away Harriet's TV time. That was before I learned I could blackmail her with how she really spent my parents' date nights. Anyway, on a rainy Sunday at precisely 4:02 p.m., the old cathode tube gave out just as I was completing level 8 of Monster Dodgers. Yeah, level 8. That one had taken me a week to memorize. Devastated, I stared at my reflection on the glass tube, wanting to cry, not just over level 8, but because I knew there was likely no budget for a new TV anytime soon. Finally, it came to me to reach out and place my palm on the screen. Then, it happened exactly the same as it had with Bill's transistor. The vibration began, and I viewed the repair. However, the hope that it brought quickly became anguish, because the repair would require a soldering iron, and the most complex tool in my dad's arsenal was a multi-tool that came as a free gift with a wine and cheese wheel. I tried to come up with a scheme to scam back my allowance money. When it came to me, Mr. Crane would have a soldering tool. He had to. That guy had everything, and I mean everything. One Sunday, I'd seen him in his garage with a blowtorch. Now, if I told him it was for my dad, I knew it would be a definite no. But if I could get him to believe that we had a repairman over, there was a slight chance. Luckily for me, the old man wasn't home, and Mrs. Crane gave me what I needed. Back at my house, I followed the instructions I just viewed and had the TV working in less than half an hour. The next Saturday, I had two regularly scheduled programs on my private viewing network. Unfortunately, the TV never showed me anything of interest, but it's disorienting to watch yourself play a video game. It wasn't until late into my freshman year that I started learning how to use my viewing moments to my advantage. I guess I was a late bloomer, because while all the kids I hung around with were chasing after girls, I was still playing video games or reading comics. Until I met Mary Louise. She was a freshman just like me, and really, I never noticed her until the day she wore that white blouse that April. Our desks were jammed way too close in those old rooms, so I would have had to lean sideways to see the board, too timid to ask her to move over. That all changed the day she walked in wearing the thin fabric over her lacy bra. I could see every detail, front and back, as if she were topless. I didn't learn much in class that day, other than what it felt like to be lovesick. For the entire period, I did nothing but sit mesmerized by Mary Louise. That was the first time the thought occurred to me that I could use my gift to my advantage. I didn't have an exact plan, but my mind ran with hundreds of possibilities, all ending with seeing that bra. Whatever she'd done to me was infectious, because after the dismissal bell, I saw the girls in my school in a completely different way. My newfound appreciation turned to Mrs. Vagel, the French teacher, who put Mary Louise's under things to shame. Remembering she had a TV in her classroom, the standard 20-inch kind bolted to a wheeled card, inspiration finally struck. The next morning, I did something I wasn't especially proud of. Unsure if it would work, I sneaked into her class 15 minutes before she arrived and busted her TV. Less than a minute after I yanked the circuit board, the vision began. It felt like cheating, considering that I was the one who had caused it. But either way, the picture movie showed me how to reconnect what I'd just undone. A week later, as I sat in algebra, I had the pleasure of viewing Vagel from clear across the school. For the entire period, I got to watch the room, and fortunately, the goddess who instructed the class never disappointed. By that time, I was figuring out how all of this worked. Whenever I fixed something, a week later, I could see through it. It was the same as the transistor. If the device was on, I saw what it saw. It was already late in the year, but I met with Mr. Spencer, who ran the AV club. He explained that he would let me join, but because of my late start, I wouldn't have the privileges the other kids had, like being in the yearbook photo. I nodded, playing the game, thinking the whole time, like I give a shit, those kids don't like me anyway. All I wanted was to find a way into the girls' locker room. The AV group met every Tuesday and Thursday after school, divvying up the to-do list, making sure the teachers' requests were met, and maintaining the equipment. For obvious reasons, I quickly became one of the top technicians. Not only did I tune up the simple stuff like erasing squiggly lines on the videotapes, but I also resurrected, as Mr. Spencer said, several of the TVs that had been out of circulation for a while. I'd like to say that I learned a lot during that time, but really it was just simple memorization. The instructions hung in my head until I completed the task. It was like walking into a test with a cheat sheet. The other guys in the group were a timid bunch, go figure, so they didn't push back too hard when I refused to do anything after school. If I fixed it, it had to be during school hours, and I did my best to stagger the times. If they overlapped, I would get two viewings at the same time. And let me tell you, until you get used to it, you get nauseous seeing so much, and that's not a lot of fun. By the end of that semester, my list of viewing materials had grown to a point where I only had free hours at night. It certainly helped me get through the boredom of my class load. The distraction tanked my grades, but by then, I'd mastered my parents' signatures, so as long as I passed, it wasn't an issue. My parents were always open to being lied to. When they asked how school was, I could make up whatever I felt like, and they ate it up without so much as a single question. Everything was going well until the day Mr. Grundy put in the request for the TV-VCR combo to be brought into his room. That was the day that I learned that greed was, indeed, bad. It's useless to look back, but I still do it all the time. Grundy was the prototypical a-hole teacher who got off on making the semester as hard as he could for his students. His specialty was calculus, and his final exam was legendary. Most kids spent a week studying for it, and for their efforts, they were happy with a D. During my fourth period world history class, right before lunch, my viewing was of an empty room. Normally, this would upset me. At this point, I'd become an addict for having, at minimum, two things going, but the TV was facing Grundy's desk. Sitting in plain view on top of the desk was the answer grid for the final. It was the old multiple-choice circle sheet that required a number two pencil. An opportunity not to be missed, I copied the answers into my notebook. As a freshman, I knew only one senior, Lenny Marotti, and it was because our dads worked in the same office, keeping an inventory of auto parts. I hunted him down after school, remembered his locker was in the north wing, and made the proposition. $20 for the answers. He was a beefy guy, not all fat, just overall larger than everyone else, which helped him play for the football team and intimidate me. Pulling me into the locker room, he made me guarantee that the answers were legit before trying to negotiate the price down. With him hovering over me and with both arms pressing me against the wall, I convinced him that the cheat sheet was legit by offering him all of my game cartridges if I was wrong. That did the trick. We settled on $15, and I gave him the answers. Well, the overgrown goon had a bigger mouth than I had expected. By the weekend, half the football team had a copy of the test, and wouldn't you know it, Brandon, the quarterback, aren't those guys supposed to be the smart ones? Got pinched with it. Worried that it would hurt his scholarship, the shithead squealed on Lenny. I didn't get that information from a viewing moment. Oddly enough, Mary Louise, wearing a cream top with a fantastic black bra beneath, told Doug Linderman in health class while I viewed kids' reactions to an instructional video on the female reproductive system. It wasn't easy to ignore that one as it was choice viewing, but when I heard about someone getting nabbed with all the answers to Grundy's test, it certainly got my attention. Knowing that I had to get to Lenny, I counted down the last 10 minutes of class, feeling like they were measured in dog years. I caught him in the hall leading to his locker and got him to follow me to the locker room. He laughed when I begged him not to turn me in, and it was the first time I realized that killing meant nothing to me. I wasn't angry or passionate. I was just there, watching the jowls of his neck shake as he laughed. As he did, I decided there was only one way to stop him, and that was when I pulled the penknife from my pocket and, well, I jabbed it right into his fat neck. That shut him up real quick. I'd seen enough TV to somewhat anticipate the blood that would shoot from the wound, but let me tell you, it gushed out like a river. Always agile, I jumped onto the bench that separated the lockers and watched the stream squirt across the room. The fat idiot fell to his knees, choking on the blood that didn't paint the walls. While I watched him die, it occurred to me that it was like watching one of my viewings. Like his pain was on display simply for my amusement. Confident he was done, I washed the knife and my hands in the stainless steel sink that everyone shared, and then walked out of the locker room to lunch. Burritos were on offer. I never felt great about eating them after hearing the rumor about someone finding a Band-Aid in one. Halfway through lunch, I heard the squad car pull up. Munching thoughtfully to make sure it was only burrito material I was chewing, I watched the teachers gather. A few minutes later, Mr. Swenson stood on the stage of the shared auditorium that the goofy-ass school made us eat in. He called for everyone's attention and said that no one could leave the room as there had been an accident. I wondered if he knew what really had happened or if he was just trying to keep everyone calm. That was the day I learned how easy it was to kill someone and get away with it. School was closed for the rest of the week, making for some boring viewings, which made me dread summer. What if someone was dumb enough to leave their TV on all summer? I'd never thought it through, but I could have been close to being stuck looking at dull, empty classrooms. What I did learn was that cheating didn't pay off. I didn't care that Lenny was dead. I probably saved his future wife from a lifetime of abuse, but I did realize that I could have been caught. Later, I found out that Coach Mester had been in his office, 4 rows of lockers away from... Well, that's how close it had been. Who knows what would have happened if that old shit hadn't been sneaking in a nap or whatever he'd been doing. That worried me to the point that I promised myself that next time, I would be a lot more careful.
Moro Casino. America's social casino.
Welcome to Moto Casino, where the excitement never ends. With thousands of the hottest free-to-play social casino games, fastest payouts, and the best promotions in the industry. No tricks or gimmicks. Owned and operated in the USA.
Moto Casino is a free-to-play social casino. No purchase necessary. 21 plus to play. Void where prohibited.
Sign up today for a generous welcome bonus.
Moto Casino. America's social casino.
Download the Moto Casino app today.
The remainder of high school was more of the same. Not killing, I took some time off from that, but my viewing calendar kept expanding. My 7-period day was filled, and I even had 4 overlaps in there. My nights were fairly open, except for the transistor. Bill eventually left it in a box in his attic, so that was a tough hour until the batteries drained because the moron had left the power on. The only other night viewing was Harriet's Walkman. I should have known better, and I did, but I thought I might catch a glimpse of Barbara, Harriet's buxom best friend, when they did dance aerobics together. So I fixed the tape-playing machine after she sat on it. If I'd known that Harriet sometimes kept it in her bra when she went walking, I would have bought her a new one and saved myself a lot of trauma. As I watched those enormous, sweaty melons swinging, the hardest part was that I could still see the awful broadcast, even when I closed my eyes. That was when I learned that, although I could receive transmissions, I had no control over the connection. As I said before, you get addicted to other people's lives pretty quickly, so I had to find a way to fill my nights. It had gotten to the point that I got anxious when I saw reality in front of me. That prompted me to look for a way to increase the frequency between 5 and midnight. And that was what brought me to the video store, the first real job I ever had. I was hired as a clerk at Galaxy Video, and within a week, I had access to the rental VCRs. It was perfect. My main job was hunting down movies for the customers. This was a small operation that had tags beneath the cardboard artwork instead of the actual VHS tapes, which were stored in the back room behind the counter. Whenever it got slow, I would sit in the back and tune up the rental machines, whether they needed it or not. And within 2 weeks, I had a full night schedule going. I learned a lot about people then. One of the biggest things I learned was how perverted they were. Half of what I saw at night was weirdos watching porno flicks and enjoying themselves. It was a lot of fun when it was couples imitating what they watched, but there were far more guys jerking off alone. If I thought watching Harriet was bad, it was nothing compared to watching some hairy-ass a-hole go to town on himself. I really thought I'd learned something about cheating with the Lenny event, but I guess I was a slow learner. Of all the people to have a pervert in their family, I was shocked to find out that Mary Louise's dad had a peculiar fetish. It was during my Thursday 10 p.m. viewing that I got to watch the dentist jack himself off with a plastic bag over his head while watching one of Galaxy Video's nastier pornos. Some of the stuff that came out of the back room with the beads over the door was downright disgusting. None of the teenagers who worked there were allowed to check them out, but we would when no one was looking. I've never been one to judge others, but if you need to watch that kind of stuff to climax, you probably need some help. Unfortunately for Mary Louise, her dad was one of them. I didn't have a choice, but it was mesmerizing to watch him get started, and then a minute in, place a plastic bag over his head and start sucking on the clear plastic until he passed out. The guy must have been some sort of jack-off genius to time it out like he did and to know that he was going to wake up. Then again, maybe that was the rush, thinking that maybe he wouldn't. It really wasn't my thing, so I didn't spend a lot of time thinking about it. The whole deal lasted less than 10 minutes, and my own TV was occupied by my dad watching some boring-ass documentary. So I was stuck looking at the balding naked dude with his shorts dangling around his legs, sleeping off the jizz high he was on with my dad next to me. As I looked around the room to avoid him, I saw something that interested me. Next to the bed was a small makeup table. I kinda hoped it belonged to the dentist's wife and wasn't another fetish. On the table sat a huge magnifying mirror, and in the reflection I saw a dresser and a wall safe. The safe should have been hidden behind a painting. There was a dirty outline on the wallpaper where the painting should have been hanging. And on the safe was a post-it note with a series of numbers in scribbled ink. Jackpot. That night, I went back and forth a couple hundred times trying to decide how much could possibly be in the safe. I told myself I was just daydreaming, but to be honest, I knew I would find a way to get in there and clean it out. The next morning, before leaving for school, I found their address in the phone book. If I went a half mile in the wrong direction, I discovered I could check it out on my walk to school. A week went by before I was confident that I could get in and out with relative ease. Mary Louise was an only child, and her mother worked as a hygienist at her father's office. Calling from a payphone, I disguised my voice and tried to make a dental appointment for Friday after school. Both had other patients, but could see me the next week on Tuesday. I knew Mary Louise was in band, and Friday was homecoming, so she would be out of the way as well. This was no longer a what-if. I had to know what was in that safe. That only left one obstacle. Could I fit in the doggy door? They had a cocker spaniel, but the vinyl flap was twice the size it had to be. From what I could see from their neighbor's yard, they had an old shed I could hide behind, and I felt confident that I could contort myself through. I was eager to get going that afternoon, but chose to wait until 4:30 because there was a more distracting viewing at 4. It was the AV TV that was now in the teacher's lounge, and on Fridays, the alcohol came out to welcome the weekend. I expected the rented VCR to be blacked out by 4:30. Everything worked perfectly. As it turned out, I was right. There was no viewing. I could have managed it if there were, but it was better this way. My first obstacle was nothing. The doggy door took no effort. With almost no pressure, I slipped right through. The cocker spaniel was asleep. As I tiptoed past, for a brief second, it looked up at me, and then went right back to its nap. I had memorized the combination, but I had a copy in my jeans pocket as backup. With a few turns, the door opened, and inside, sitting next to a few papers, were several necklaces and a pile of cash. I didn't know it at the time, but it was slightly under 10 grand. I know it's not that much all in all, but it was a real score for a teenager in the early 90s. I left the jewelry, I had no clue how to sell something like that, and made my way down the stairs. If it weren't for the motherfucking reed for the saxophone, everything would have gone down perfectly. I must have been half deaf or impaired by adrenaline, because I did not hear Mary Louise walking up the stairs. She wore a tan dickie with a white bra underneath. It was made to go beneath her band jacket. I rounded the corner, my backpack filled with the perverted dentist's loot, and almost knocked her over. She had an almost amused look on her face as she asked, "Aren't you the guy from my algebra class?" I remember being surprised that she didn't scream or ask what I was doing there. That was the last emotion I felt as I grabbed the hunting knife, which I'd upgraded from the penknife in case I needed it for the dog, and plunged it into her eye socket. I didn't do it to be gruesome. To be honest, I was planning on jamming it into her chest and totally whiffed. Before she could scream, I spun her around and had my hand over her mouth. My only thought was wondering if she liked the oxygen deprivation, like her father. She didn't struggle much, she just kinda twitched in a half-assed way. I was surprised that I didn't think of her in a sexual way. I could have done whatever I wanted, but the moment we shared was more important than that. There was blood, but less than I thought there would be. I was wearing gloves, so I wasn't overly concerned, but then I noticed the darkened portion of my army jacket with the stencil of the Violent Femmes on the back. I was pissed. That patch was hard to come by. I knew I would have to toss it, but I really didn't want to. I left the same way I came, frustrated not only by needing to ditch my jacket before I got back, but also by the reed. If she hadn't forgotten it, she still would have been alive, and I would still get to enjoy watching her in her AP class at my 2 o'clock viewing. That lazy-ass teacher did little but play videos. The money came in handy, even though I could only use small portions of it at any time. I kept it buried between the pages of my comic book collection, knowing it would be safe there. The last time anyone but me was in my bedroom was when I had a nasty flu in the 6th grade. I kept my job at the video store, even though I didn't need the pay. It gave me the potential for unlimited viewings, which was good, even if I was tired of listening to the other clerks gabbing all day. I never quite understood their need to share every bit of bullshit that went through their heads, but they sure as hell thought they might explode if they didn't get it all out. By the time high school was over, I had a pretty good schedule going that ran morning to night. I even experimented during my sleeping hours. I was hesitant at first, but tried it for the shit of it, figuring I could always destroy the camera at the Stop and Save gas station if it kept me up too late. I learned a pretty neat thing with that experiment. I could ignore it if the viewing started when I was asleep, which was great because then there was no risk. I didn't kill again until I was 20. I'm not gonna lie, it surprised me. Mary Louise introduced me to bloodlust in the same way she had sexual lust. When I say that, I know it makes me sound like a maniac, but it really isn't like that at all. I've relived that moment in the hallway with her 1,000 times. If I'm being honest at this point, and there's no reason not to, everything I do now is geared toward trying to relive that exact experience. And that's why I keep stabbing them in the eye. It isn't like the reporters say. It isn't because I see myself in the victims, or better yet, that I don't want them to see me because I feel shame. It's simply because her hallway was dark, and the angle wasn't quite what I thought it was. The a-hole shrinks finally have me convinced that I probably don't understand love. But that moment with her is probably the closest I've come to it. That longing is always there. Only the intensity toward it changes. Once it gets to a certain point, there's no stopping it. I mean, I guess that's kind of bullshit because I've never really tried to stop it. I was still working at the video store and living at home 2 years out of high school. Harriet had roped a poor sucker into marrying her. His name was Sam. He worked down at the grocery store as a general manager. I guess he made decent money. He had a clean apartment and his car wasn't even 2 years old. The dude couldn't have weighed more than 140 pounds soaking wet. In their wedding photos, they looked like the number 10. My parents watched in their quiet, oblivious way. It was just us now, which was good. Harriet was the only one who'd kept an eye on me. With her out of the way, I could come and go as I pleased without having to make up any bullshit. The video store gig was paying off. The rental VCRs were being sold as newer models came in, so the viewings kept increasing. It was getting to the point that there was rarely less than a half hour per day without a double feature, and in some cases, I was getting triples. Those were rough. I could easily watch two viewings and hold a conversation in my present reality, but when a third came in, I became nearly comatose. That's what led me back to the old high school. I had outgrown that scene, except for Mrs. Vagel, but I was willing to sacrifice her at that point. The truth was, she'd put on some weight, and her underwear became less desirable. At the time, I didn't have the same control I have today, which is why I had to sneak in and destroy the TVs to stop the viewings that had given me so much enjoyment. It was the first time I'd done something sneaky that didn't result in someone being killed. I still had the key to the AV room. Dumbass Spence still never unlocked the front doors until a few minutes before class. A minute after he did, I just walked in and ripped out all the wiring in the back of the TVs. It would have been more satisfying if I'd smashed them, but I didn't want to risk making that much noise. I knew I could have pulled it off. You'd be surprised how getting away with two murders gives you a feeling of complete invincibility. But I thought better of it. I got mixed results after extinguishing those connections. A week later, my viewings went down by way more than half, but what I didn't expect was the emptiness. I wasn't used to feelings like that. I wasn't used to anything other than the urges. I knew I could feel boredom, longing, and lust, but anything outside of that was new. Knowing what I know now, I realize how unique that is. It's a lot like when I first saw how to fix that transistor. If you don't talk about it with anyone, how do you know how others' feelings or experiences compare to yours? I read half of a philosophy book once. I read it while working at the video store in between fetching the cassettes. It was boring as shit, but one part really stuck out to me. It was a simple statement that's always stayed with me. It was more complex than this, but the gist was that the only way you can learn about yourself is through interactions with others. I've never read a truer statement. If I thought nothing about killing someone, how in the hell was I supposed to know it was wrong unless someone else could explain why it was wrong? I'm no philosopher, but what I later learned to be sadness, I was missing the connection to the school, is what brought me to my first therapy session, where I began to learn how different I was. I had enough dough to pay someone, but didn't want to go through that bullshit, mainly because I didn't want to fill out a mountain of forms. But I found a pretty good solution two towns over in Damotson. Every Friday night, in the basement of a church, they held community forums and offered free counseling. That wasn't completely true. They did ask for donations, but it wasn't mandatory. I made a big deal out of dropping $20 into the box so the old bitch at the door would think I was a genuine type of guy. But the money never made it into the box. I just flashed it and then palmed it before pretending to push it through the slot. The rooms were full of a collection of losers who thought hanging in groups somehow elevated them to something else. Of all of them, the biggest group was alcoholics. I hated staring at them as they drank that shitty coffee and chain-smoked. When I ventured in that night, I met Miss Stacy, the psychologist who gave free sessions. She was plump, but pretty, maybe 40. I was sly and asked roundabout questions, disguising the real questions that I wanted to ask, the way they do on the idiot television shows Harriet used to watch. Honestly, I didn't know what was considered acceptable or not. To me, there was nothing wrong with saying I had stabbed some a-hole jock because I didn't want to be kicked out of school. I knew it should be wrong, but I just didn't feel it. It was kind of like those arranged marriages you hear about. Someone tells you to love someone because it's in everyone's best interests, so the couple does it. Not for love, but just being aware that they should. So I made up an elaborate story about missing my friends from high school, even though I wasn't close to them, just to see what she had to say. She gave me some nearly insightful answers, but I was growing impatient. I knew, at best, that I could go there maybe twice. I was paranoid about sharing too much. So then I did something that became a pattern in my life. I took a risk without thinking. I told her that I was picked on a lot in high school and had fantasies about killing some of the bigger kids who tormented me. Over time, I found that lies that were close to the truth almost always worked. The kids in school had picked on me relentlessly, but honestly, I'd never blamed them. I just figured they'd sensed my weirdness. It was like those documentaries I get stuck watching with my dad from time to time on Saturdays after the soldering repair so long ago. There was an order to things in the natural world. Animals had an instinctive sense that gave them a place and meaning in relation to their surroundings, and when they encountered anything that triggered them, they went on the attack. As I've thought about it over the years, that's what I believe makes me different. That sense is missing in me. I not only have no barometer pointing me to what's right or wrong, but I also have no desire to develop one. I had a sort of half-assed theory that everyone's brain would live up to a certain potential based on the geography up there. The area where connection, love, and understanding should be in my brain was filled with the ability to view. It's kind of funny how the thing that makes me unique is also the thing that alienates me from others. Now, with Miss Stacy, I was trying to figure out what kind of bra she was wearing. Her sweater was tight, but had a weird quilted pattern, making identifying it difficult. With her wild smile, she told me that it was normal to feel aggressive like this. Finally, progress. Someone was showing me behind the curtain, which always seemed to be closed. I went a little further and told her that I'd even planned how I would do it. She explained that this was also normal and asked about my parents. Then I opened up more than I'd planned and told her about the nothingness of our relationship. I told her about the day they locked me in the closet because I was being too loud, and admittedly, I really was being obnoxious that day. It was the day after my fourth birthday, and I couldn't get my toy car track to stay together. I also told her how I screamed myself to sleep that night in the dark. I could see she found that distressing. She had to be wearing one of those cross-your-heart bras. Harriet had a few like that, as they were the only things that could contain her. Miss Stacy asked if that was the first time I'd ever spoken to someone about that incident. When I answered yes, she scribbled something down in a notebook. I didn't like that, but I tolerated it, figuring she had no way of knowing who I really was, so nothing she wrote could follow me anywhere. She went on to explain that children who were abused in such a way often found it hard to get along with others in their same age group. She said that they usually aren't able to feel safe or trust anyone because of their betrayal. I was getting really bored. If I hadn't been viewing some bald guy laying into his fat-ass wife, I probably would have walked out. They were trying to mimic the porno they were watching, and it was hilarious listening to them repeating back the ridiculous lines that were obviously meant for better-looking people. Thinking these meetings only lasted an hour at most, I interrupted as she made a passionate speech, trying to get me to open up about anything physical that might have happened to me. I really thought about lifting my shirt and showing her the something physical that had caused the scars across my back, but I finally decided to cut to the chase. That was another one of my grandma-isms that I was really fond of. I flat out asked her how many visions she saw in a day. By how she looked, you would have thought I'd asked her if she'd ever been double penetrated. I will openly admit that I've never been good with facial expressions. I notice differences in facial muscles. I have very good vision, but I just don't always understand what faces mean when they change. I always have to wait for words to interpret the movement for me. When she said, "I don't quite understand," I thought perhaps it was a game to get me to open up more. I pretty much knew that not everyone got an instruction book on how to fix things, but I had no idea at all that someone smart, like a doctor, didn't see multiple things at once. I caught on quick that I'd botched it up by asking, though, and now I wanted to leave. Instead, I ignored the viewing, which wasn't easy because the bald guy had just pulled out a thick belt, and I listened to Miss Stacy. If I had to guess, I would say her expression was compassionate, as she placed the notebook down and leaned forward with her elbows on her thighs. The motion put the cross your heart bra to the test. She stared right into my eyes, I always hated that, and asked me what I saw. I backtracked and told her I didn't see actual visions. I just saw myself wanting to do things in my mind. She grilled me on that. She was a sharp one, trying to open me up again, but I thought I did a good job of convincing her. When our time was up, she gave me her card, wrote her home number on the back, and asked me to promise her that I would come back the following week. I thanked her, and when I did, I meant it. With her home number, it would be easy to track her down now if I decided to kill her. The next week, I didn't go back. It wasn't from fear or anything like that. I thought Miss Stacy was either a liar or stupid. She had to know that some, if not all, people saw visions. From my perspective, they had to. Maybe she acted like she didn't because that subject was one of those subtle things that polite people didn't ask about. Mrs. Vagel had been the first to introduce me to that phrase when she caught me asking my schoolmate Pat if she used a vibrator. Thinking back on it, Miss Stacy had the same look on her face as Mrs. Vagel had as she sat me down and explained that she wouldn't send me to the principal if I promised I understood what I'd done wrong. I'd done what I always did. I lied.
Moro Casino, America's social casino.
Welcome to Moto Casino, where the excitement never ends, with thousands of the hottest free-to-play social casino games, fastest payouts, and the best promotions in the industry. No tricks or gimmicks. Owned and operated in the USA.
Moto Casino is a free-to-play social casino. No purchase necessary. 21 plus to play. Void where prohibited.
Sign up today for a generous welcome bonus.
Moto Casino, America's social casino.
Download the Moto Casino app today.
My next big adventure was trying to find a replacement for the old AV TVs. The VCRs were still paying off, but DVD players were slowly replacing them. The moron who owned Galaxy Video refused to buy any of the new machines, as he told us they were a fad, so he wasn't going to waste time on them. The dude had always been a dipshit. I had a few additions to my schedule, a TV or a car radio here or there, but I was desperate to get my fix. You'd be amazed at how many people just sat and watched their VCRs and did nothing interesting. An idea formed when I bought new sheets at B-Mart, the one and only department store in our town. As the idiot behind the register struggled with three quarters to count out the exact change, I noticed the closed-circuit television screen behind the acne-scarred a-hole in a striped smock. If I could tap into each camera, it would be like striking oil in your backyard as you were digging for a fence post. I left the store, scheming up a way to get in there at night. As I tried to figure out a way to bypass the security system, I stood beneath the nearest outdoor camera. If I came up tight against the wall, there was no way it could capture my image. And with a little planning, it could work. As I'd done with Mary Louise's parents' house, I cased the place over the next few days. The best plan was to get to the main terminal. I assumed this was in the manager's office at the back of the store, next to the returns and complaint department. Without asking, I had no way of telling, but it was the most logical location. On a Tuesday, just after lunch, I once again acted without thinking. Standing in the gift wrap and card aisle for way too long, I watched the blonde woman who managed the store walk into her office. There was no camera in this hallway, and the returns desk was empty. I took this as a sign and acted. I walked up to the door and grabbed the handle, but it was locked. The plan had been to open the door, see what was inside, and say I thought it was the bathroom. While my hand was still on the knob, someone pulled the door open. About a foot away from me was the ridiculously hairsprayed hairdo of the manager. She kind of frowned and giggled at the same time, saying, "You startled me. Can I help you with something?" For the life of me, I don't know why I reacted the way I did. Maybe it was because she looked like a skinny version of Harriet. Maybe it was because I was really hurting for more viewings. It was the first time I had felt anger before I killed. In the way that I'd practiced so many times in my mirror, I buried the knife in her face so fast that her facial expression didn't have a chance to change. The serrated edge did its job. There wasn't even a scream. In that moment, I fully appreciated the power the longing had over me. The wave of pleasure that came over me was not remotely close to anything I'd ever experienced. Knowing this wasn't the place to relax, I grabbed the slumping woman by her suit jacket and bra, not sure which kind, but it sure was tight, and pushed her into the room. I locked the door behind me and cleaned my knife. I felt amazingly calm. I learned later that this wasn't unusual, especially if there's been a lot of time between kills, but it was a first back then. I sat in the office chair behind her desk and felt pretty fucking smart, because next to the desk was a wall of screens with a control panel beneath them. Looking at the screens, I was confident that no one saw what had just happened. I took my knife, flipped open the control panel, and ripped apart the wiring and circuitry of the camera feeds. While I waited for the instruction book, I moved the photo of the manager and her family face down. I remember reading in the paper later that they thought the killer had done this because they felt guilty and because the family was staring at them. Dumb a-holes. I did it because her daughter was an ugly pig and I couldn't deal with looking at her. I placed my hand on the keyboard and the instructions led the way. Looking at what it was going to take to fix it, I wanted to kick myself for making it so complicated, but I knew the effort would be worth it if I could view all the cameras at once. I had every tool imaginable inside the pocket of my new army surplus jacket, and I was glad I did. Half an hour later, I had the circuit board back together again. While I had access to the instructions, I also saw how to erase the 24-hour tapes. So I erased them and put on a 10-minute delay to cover my tracks. The whole time, I felt like someone was going to knock on the door, but never once did this bother me. It just helped me stay focused and ready with the knife. When I was done, I wiped the place down. I have no idea if this mattered, but I did it anyway. Then I propped up the manager in her chair and walked out of the store. As I made my way down the aisle, scanning for anyone nearby who could have seen me leaving the room, I was viewing a family watching a dumbass movie about a professor who had shrunk his family. I felt complete. If everyone around me felt like I did right then, I finally understood what TV and philosophy books couldn't teach me. Life was about experiences. These moments give you purpose and fulfillment. It reminded me of an advertisement I once saw in a comic that I used to think was lame. The tagline said, "Be high on life," and the characters were all high-fiving one another. I admit, if I'd had a friend, I would have high-fived them right then. That was until I saw Mark Sullivan. He was buying a quart of oil and some beef jerky from the jerk at the register. I was so fucking close to getting out of there clean until that Cro-Magnon a-hole turned his head. He looked right at me without nodding, but I knew he recognized me. Like I said, facial expressions are not easy for me, but I knew I had to kill him. Mark was a few years older than me. I'd met him at Galaxy Video. He was the one who had trained me how to grab the tags and pull the movies from the bag. The dude was a real genius, mastering such a complex skill. We'd only worked together for a short time. The boss had caught him swiping films. The gay kind. The one he'd gotten caught had a cover with two shirtless dudes working on a hot rod. I was the only one in back when he was let go, and the look he gave me then was the same look he was giving me now. My hide didn't completely deflate, but I wasn't too pleased with needing to share it. Knowing what had to be done, I did something that I absolutely hate. I made eye contact with him and smiled as I walked out of the store. It took some practice, but at this point I was getting pretty good at it. I knew I had little time to make a decision. The camera delay lasted only a few minutes. I saw his Stang, which I had always heard him calling his Mustang, so it kind of stuck. The guy was really into cars, and he had this one decked out. It had the engine coming through the hood and other enhancements I didn't give two shits about. The plan came to me quickly, so I walked up to it and leaned against the driver's side, knowing I needed to take care of this now. I couldn't chance him seeing a news report and calling in saying he'd seen me there. Maybe I was being paranoid, but I wasn't going to end this high. Mark left the store and came up to me. I guess he found me sexually attractive because when I asked him for a ride, he simply said, "Sure, jump in." We got out of there quickly enough to beat out the camera. Trying to impress me, he peeled out of the parking lot, shooting smoke and gravel into the air and making a shitload of noise. Knowing we were now out of the range of the cameras, I felt calm and, I guess, superior, like I was meant to be doing these things, because if I wasn't, it wouldn't have been this easy. On that day of firsts, I let Mark drive me to the local forest preserve, knowing full well that he was trying to seduce me. When we pulled into the wooded area, the parking lot was empty. As soon as we backed into the space, he leaned over and put his hands between my legs without warning. I really don't know why, but I didn't resist. I even let him kiss me. Inside, I felt nothing. It wasn't because he was a man. My sexual tastes revolved around women's clothing. The people who wore them meant nothing more than adding shape to what I desired. This being my first sexual experience on my day of firsts, I was willing to let it play out. I really wasn't sure how this worked other than what I'd seen in a few viewings. He already had his pants down, and if he hadn't pulled up my shirt the way he did, I would have let him do whatever he wanted. But once my shirt was up, he saw the hunting knife in its sheath. His eyes got really wide, giving me a good target. But I missed anyway. He turned at the very last second, and the tip went right into his ear. At that angle, it stopped as it struck bone in his neck. I'll give it to him. The dude was tough and fast. He screamed and grabbed the knife's handle. I guess that hurt a lot, because the second he touched it, the wound started to gush. I knew I could finish him off quickly and easily, but I just sat back and enjoyed the show. With blood shooting at the windshield, he opened the door and tried to run. He didn't make it two steps before his pants caught him up and he fell flat on his face. I climbed across the car and stood above him. He grasped at the ground for I don't know what. As I knelt to finish him off, he rolled over, smacking my thigh with his boner. The thing was huge. One good jab, and the knife finished him off. When I got back to the car, I pulled out the radio faceplate and rewired it. I figured anyone driving a car like that might give me some interesting viewings. That afternoon, I had a long walk back to my parents' house. It gave me time to think. As I walked along the road, I had two overlapping viewings. Both were boring, just families going about their stupid-ass lives. It was cold, or else I would have ditched my jacket. It had a lot of blood on it, but it was checkered camouflage, so it blended in pretty good. Eventually, a squad car passed. My heart didn't skip a beat, even as it slowed down. I just kept walking, focusing on the viewings. The car kept going without lighting up, and I was grateful for that. I knew I could have taken care of the cop, but didn't quite feel up to it. I was coming down slightly from the high in a good way and didn't want anything to change. It was one of those perfect moments, a moment when you feel like you're floating above all the bullshit that life puts you through. Walking along, I pulled the collar up to my chin. I could smell the manager lady on the coat. Right then, I knew I was in deep. This time, there wouldn't be a 2-year gap until the next adventure. Honestly, I doubted I could hold out for much longer than 2 weeks. It was nearly 2 hours before I got home. As soon as I got back, I wrapped the jacket in a plastic garbage bag. I would dump it the first chance I got. Until then, it would be safe in my closet. I knew I was clear, but I flipped on the news as I warmed up my turkey TV dinner. The next few years brought a lot of change. Harriet had her first baby. The kid took after her. It was probably one of the fattest babies ever born. She brought the porker to our parents' house every Sunday night for dinner. Even though it made her suspicious, I rarely went upstairs to visit. I didn't like the change in my routine. On Sunday nights, I'd managed two excellent back-to-back viewings. Both were women's groups, and they wore the most amazing clothes, trying to look respectful as they looked for support. Because it was a weekend, I would allow myself a more expensive chicken fried steak instead of my usual turkey while watching. I'd found that, by viewing BeamArt's surveillance, multiple cameras were the way to go. It was rare when one of the cameras didn't pick up at least one really good viewing. By then, my VCRs weren't really paying out anymore, as DVDs had taken over, proving the dumbass video store owner wrong and almost closing up Galaxy Video. I didn't work there anymore, as there had been several complaints about me. A-holes talking about me not moving fast enough. I'd like to see how fast any of them moved if they saw three things at once like I did. Surprisingly, I was still living off the dentist's money and the couple of bucks I'd taken off folks when I was on my adventures. I didn't have many bills other than my TV dinners, so I didn't sweat it. When I took over the basement, my dad demanded rent. We had a conversation, and I straightened him the fuck out. The few times he saw me in the house after that, he backed away quick. It's kind of sad watching someone who you used to look up to acting like a pussy, but hey, I got my way. I visited another shrink. That guy wasn't quite the same as Miss Stacy. Halfway through, he got pretty aggressive, and that was the first time I'd ever heard the word sociopath. Unfortunately for him, I opened up a little too much. It was his last session, but it certainly wasn't mine. I'd gone there because the killings were getting out of control. It was rare when I didn't kill at least one person every month, sometimes more. At that pace, I had to figure out how to curb the urges because I knew deep down that stopping them for any prolonged period was no longer an option. I was smart about how I did them. Unless it was a special circumstance, I didn't kill in my own town anymore. It was amazingly easy to get away with the killings when you had no association with the victim. I killed most of them in the same Mary Louise way, knife to the eye. Looking back, it was dumb to do them like that. It left a traceable pattern and made them less random. I learned this by watching the interviews on the news. Even though I knew I should change this, I couldn't. There was no point in killing if I wasn't doing it this exact way. I guess I was no better than an addict chasing their high. As I was evolving, I read all I could about psychology. I wasn't exactly confused by the books, but I still didn't understand them. There was way too much about feelings for me to even grasp what I was reading. If I could just get a few answers, I could kill in a fashion that was less risky. Killing on the road was getting expensive. I managed that by taking out a few guys who didn't fit the standard profile that the news kept talking about. I would look for expensive cars in motel parking lots, using my dad's olds whenever I left town. We had an understanding now. I didn't even ask. I just took it. Almost every time, I would find the owner of the car in bed with a prostitute. The good thing about that was that there was always cash. The doors in those places might as well have been made out of cardboard, so one good kick and I was in, taking the old fucker out and then the whore. Killing them was business. There was too much noise to do the things I wanted to do, but they paid very well. That is, until I learned what a pimp was. I was 24 at the time, cruising through a dump called the Wallacondo Motel, when I saw an S-Class. Knowing it would pay off, I did what I always did, parked the olds across the street, and walked. By then, I dumped the army jacket. There had been multiple reports of a possible suspect wearing an army jacket near the scene, so now I alternated hooded sweatshirts. This place was more than a dump and was barely standing. I easily went through the door. It wasn't even locked. The old dude somehow reminded me of Mark Sullivan. He jumped out of the bed with his pants around his ankles, his boner bouncing around. A quick jab with a hunting knife shut him the fuck up quick. The prostitute must have been a gymnast. She tumbled backward off the bed. That was something to see because she was almost completely naked. Although athletic, she wasn't too bright. She mistimed her spin and cracked her head on the nightstand, the only thing in the room that looked sturdy. It was pretty funny to watch. The look of surprise on her face when she stuck it was fucking priceless. That was until I heard a grunt and a bat slammed into my shoulder. Sparks flared through my vision. I'd caught some beatings in my day, but never anything like that. Maybe it was the shock, but most likely it was the size of the dude who'd swung. I went down hard, but I had enough brains to roll when I hit the ground. If I hadn't done that just then and in that exact way, I would have been dead. On my back, I could see what had to be a 400-pound dude wearing an Adidas tracksuit, swinging the bat with both hands, bringing it down right where my head had been before I rolled. He used so much force that the bat cracked in half as it hit the shitty-ass carpeted floor, and this put him slightly off balance. I tried to use this to my advantage and stab him with my left arm, but it was a no-go. Whatever had happened when the bat made contact with my shoulder, it fucked up that arm. When the big dude saw the knife, he took a half step back, and his foot stepped directly on the arm of the old man, causing him to fly back onto the bed. I knew that was my best chance of getting out of there in one piece, but I didn't run. The door was right there, open and right in front of me, but I slowly sat up, ignoring the pain. The truth was, I wanted that money. I had other thoughts. I guess they were my version of what the shrinks would call a fight-or-flight response, but those were really quiet. They usually got that way when things were moving fast. I guess that was the one big advantage of having thoughts without any emotions. It made me more instinctual. I didn't react to a feeling because, the fact was, I didn't really have any. Somewhere deep in my head, I just thought, hey, if you leave now, you can outrun this fat a-hole. Instead, I chose to listen to the other thought. It told me that I wanted that old dude with the funny boner's money, because that money would stop me from needing a job for my TV dinners. The whole thing was simple, and I like simple. All these ideas took about 2 seconds. I'm really good at listening, and right then, I heard nothing outside the room that would change my mind. The only noise was the fat ass wheezing as he tried to roll out of the bed. Always agile, even with the injury, I kinda karate flipped myself to my feet. Unfortunately, I had no room for style. If that guy got a hold of me, he would have wrestled me to death. So I plunged the knife into his sternum. He bled like a geyser and whined like a child as he gripped the wound with his disgusting sausage fingers. With him docile, I made a quick cut to his throat to stop the noise. Knowing he was done, I poked my head outside the door and confirmed that I could still trust what I always thought was superhuman hearing. There was no movement outside. Now, I'm not a total idiot. I knew someone behind one of the curtained windows could be calling the cavalry. But in a neighborhood like that, a responder would take at least 10 minutes if they showed up at all. I felt good enough to close the door and search the place. The fat ass was almost gone. I decided to wait to search him until I knew he was. Looking through, I saw that the old dude's pants didn't have a wallet or cash in them. My first thought was that the whore had already swiped it. She was lying in a huddled mess with her neck against the leg of the nightstand. All she had on was a bra and a frayed jean skirt. It looked like cutoffs with actual pockets. I carefully made my way around the big dude. I wasn't up for one of those horror movie final jump scares, and grabbed her by the shoulder. As soon as I made contact with her, I saw instructions just like I usually did with radios and TVs. The only difference was that this wasn't showing me how to rewire a piece of plastic. I was seeing how to perform a tracheotomy. I'm not gonna lie, I didn't know that word at the time. I looked it up later. I viewed how to bend her head back and cut into her airway. I wasn't generally in the business of helping the dying, but having never experienced this before, I did what the instruction showed me. Once the knife pierced the larynx, yeah, I didn't know that word either, she gasped for air through her throat. If you've never seen this before, I'm warning you, it's not pretty. Air bubbles push the blood out, and there's a wicked gurgling noise. I had to make a choice right then. If she opened her eyes, would I kill her? Fortunately, she didn't. The bruise on her head was nasty, and she just lay there wheezing through her throat hole. I ripped her skirt off, and jammed in the back pocket was the old man's wallet. There was nearly $1,000 in cash. I was pretty happy that I'd stuck it out. Whenever I'd done this before, the most I'd gotten was $400. I put her down with a pillow behind her neck and moved her head to an angle so the blood would flow, as the instructions had shown me. With her head to the side, I immediately understood. She had some kind of space-age hearing aid jammed into her, with a wire attached behind the earlobe. That had to be why I'd seen how to fix her. Right then, I didn't really think through the significance of being linked to a human. Honestly, all I thought was, how many people did she have to blow to get that in her ear, and was it worth it? It was still quiet, but I didn't want to push it too far, and I was eager to get moving. So I got into the fat man's pocket. The material of his pants was super thin, and as I dug around, I felt all the flab of his midsection. But it was worth it. He had nearly $4,000 in small bills. My internal clock was ticking, so I pulled back the curtain and peeked through the glass. There was no movement. I walked out the door, put my hood up, and headed to my dad's Olds, covered in three different types of blood. By then, I had enough experience to have the trunk rigged. I shed the sweatshirt and wrapped it in a plastic bag. On my way back home, I was starving. I was going to try a drive-thru, but toughed it out. Knowing I was less than 2 hours from home, I wanted to celebrate the addition to my fortune over my favorite dinner. Before I was even a mile away, I had an unscheduled viewing. This one came with a headache like you wouldn't believe, and my throat felt so dry it was like I'd swallowed sandpaper. Fighting the pain, I pulled over to the side of the road. The viewing was coming from the room I'd just left. It took me a minute to figure it out, but I was seeing what the prostitute was seeing. The view was partially of the bed and the ceiling. There was a well-built woman in a nightie off in the corner, screaming into the phone that she needed an ambulance and rambling off the address. A minute later, she was on her knees, holding our hand. I know, our is an odd choice of words, but I'm telling you, I felt her hand as if she were sitting beside me in the piece of shit car my father spent so much time washing every Saturday morning. She whispered that everything was going to be all right. As I looked at her, for the first time in my life, I could read her face. She honestly cared. I was also getting a really good view of her bra. It was one of those push-up ones with the clasp in front. With all the makeup she had on, I had to guess she worked for Fat Adidas on the bed behind her. If she was a whore, I was really surprised that she was sitting there and wasn't out the door. I guess the gymnast blacked out because the viewing stopped right there. When the connection went black, my head and throat felt instantly better. My hand, though, was curved as if somebody had been holding it. I sat there in a daze. Beyond the physical pain, I also felt emotional pain. For the first time ever, I felt what I later learned to be sadness and fear. I've got to say, I didn't like it one bit. I heard sirens off in the distance, so I got back on the interstate and headed back to the basement. Along the way, the new viewing came in a few times. The first flash showed me the paramedics with some type of balloon and a stethoscope. That only lasted a minute. Then, when the next flash came, there were lights rolling over my head down a long-ass hallway. That second one was rough because I already had two other viewings going. One was a dog watching some really handsome guy sleeping on a couch while a dumbass movie about a duck superhero played. The other was back at B-Mart. A couple of women were trying on jackets. With only one arm steering and her wounds and emotions coursing through me, I was pretty amazed that I kept the car on the road. When I got back, my dad sat at the kitchen table trying to play the tough guy. I stared him down and went downstairs to my room. I was waiting for the TV dinner to finish in the microwave. It took me some time, but I'd finally figured out to ignore the instructions and cook for exactly 7 minutes, which was the only way to make sure the center of the cranberry sauce wasn't frozen. I flipped on the news. This was the 10th time one of my adventures had been on TV. The news lady wore a white turtleneck with a lacy bra underneath. You had to really look to see it, but it was there. The story she spouted off was that a solicitation appeared to have gone horribly wrong. She didn't give any graphic details or names. She only said that the police had received the information from an anonymous call. I knew Nighty was a prostitute, so she must have flown out of there right after the gymnast had passed out. However, I did wonder how much time she'd spent looking through her old boss's sweatpants and searching for all her hard-earned cash. They went back to the studio and babbled on about the election. I flipped it off and ate a second dinner. I didn't always splurge like that, but it had been a big night. Around 4 in the morning, the viewing came back. The headache was gone, but my throat hurt like a motherfucker, and my shoulder ached. This time, the viewing was a doctor arguing with 2 guys who had to be plainclothes detectives. They won the argument and started the barrage of questions. Even though the gymnast couldn't talk, I could see what she was writing. The 2 a-holes questioning her were relentless. She played dumb. It couldn't be too hard for her, but I could feel when she was lying as she used the magic marker to write out the simple yes or no answers. The only one that really mattered to me was when they asked her if she could describe the man who'd done this. That was a simple no. That was good because I felt frustration, so I knew she was telling the truth. Let me tell you, having emotions come at you like that all at once without an instruction book is rough. I had no idea what was going on or how to deal with them. All I knew was that if they kept going on like that, I would have to kill her. Then I had a real out there thought. If I could feel her pain, would I also be able to feel what she felt when she died? I didn't feel anything when I thought this, but I knew this had changed me somehow. For the first time, I pondered the future and the consequences associated with those thoughts. It might be impossible for someone who wasn't like me to believe this, but this was not how my brain worked. Typically, there were things that I needed and wanted, and I did what was necessary to get them. Now, it was different, and I didn't learn how different until later. I couldn't figure out why, but this viewing wasn't following the rules. Instead of just an hour a week, now it was always present, except for when she slept. There was also a connection to her feelings, both emotional and physical. Whenever she was awake, my throat ached, and I could feel fear and loneliness. I knew I needed to figure this out, but I also knew it wouldn't be easy. I couldn't do much. My shoulder wasn't wrecked, but I had to pay real close attention to it. My left arm was a struggle. I wasn't going to use up my TV dinner money on an a-hole doctor, so I dealt with it. During those first few days, I never left my room. That was all right. I had enough food for a couple of weeks, and I had my regular viewings to keep me busy. It would have been great if I hadn't had that woman there all the time. Her name was Penelope, but she went by Penny. I learned that she lived with 2 other girls. Neither was much to look at, and neither knew she was a hooker. Some of this I knew from the conversations they had, or should I say, from them talking to her. She still couldn't talk, which meant I couldn't talk, which was total shit. How was that fair? I also knew some of what was going on with her just because I knew, the same way that I knew I would be calm when putting a knife into someone. I knew things about this Penny. Most times, I could see parts of her past, but more than that, I could feel her. I could feel her shame when the other girls looked at her. The shame because they accepted her as one of them, one of the privileged who got to stay in the apartment off campus, except she didn't have a rich daddy to pay her part. My Penny had to suck off disgusting old men to pay her way. I could feel her at odds with fooling them into thinking she was just like them. It was very disorienting, but I could feel the anxiety she felt about them somehow finding out, and all the paranoid thoughts that the cops would show up at the door and expose her and the fake life she'd created. They would reveal her real life, where her mother was dead and her father used up the monthly disability check to drink himself into oblivion every night, leaving her to make it on her own. I could feel how hard she worked in school, surviving on the hot lunch they gave her because there wasn't any food at home. How she knew if she could graduate from college, she could get a job and have the life she'd dreamed of as a little girl. I could feel the day the acceptance letter had come, and then the last line talking about budget cuts and how her scholarship would cover only half the expenses. I could feel the memory of the pain of her first time in the back seat of an old man's car, and how degrading it had been to take the bills from him as he sat there with his boner sticking out of his pants. It was so real that I could feel the pain between my legs and remember telling myself that it would all be worth it once school was done. Then I could get a real job and wipe all this from my memory. I could feel all this the same way I felt the pain in my shoulder. It didn't take long for me to know that I had to kill her as soon as I was able. Until then, I had no choice but to put up with all those bullshit feelings. I probably should have just gone to a doctor when the days became weeks, but I started to realize that maybe Penny was special. I just couldn't believe that everyone else could feel like this. With all that inside you, how could you function? My shoulder wasn't perfect. It had this weird clicking noise, but I felt strong enough to get back out there. Maybe I was pushing too hard, but I had to take care of her. I just couldn't deal with those feelings. This adventure was going to be a chore, and it wasn't going to feel as good. It was too easy being able to see myself coming, but I looked at it like killing old dudes for their cash. It was a means to an end, like my grandma used to say. Friday was my normal killing night, as usual, always trying to relive Mary Louise, and this Friday looked like Penny was going to be there alone. The two homely chicks who lived with her weren't great face-wise, but I'd seen the taller one in her bra, which was one of the best viewings I'd ever seen. When the two chicks begged Penny to go to a concert, my girl refused. I'd still done my homework and checked out the place four nights in a row to see what the neighborhood was like. They lived on the middle floor of an old brownstone. The top and bottom floors had students as well. There was a back stairway without a gate, then narrow alleys separating almost identical buildings flanking her place. There was a shit ton of windows, so there was a lot of exposure. This was obviously not ideal, but I knew I would press ahead. While sharing her thoughts, I knew that she wouldn't venture out alone anytime soon. She had enough dick-sucking money to last her for a while, and the school had told her to take as much time as she needed to recover. I might have waited even another week, but her period had just started and I felt her cramps. Let me tell you, that is rough, and that pushed me over the edge. The night came. There was only a partial moon and there were no streetlights in the back of the buildings. I wore my black hooded sweatshirt with a camo tee underneath. After much consideration, I chose the building four houses down as an entry point. It extended the walk, but there were enough shrubs to give me cover. I got to the back of the building and had her constant viewing at the same time as the remaining VCRs, which was good. Although the VCR had a shapely woman, I could tune her out. There were a few lights on, which was preferable because I could see if someone was looking out. It was now or never. So I walked head down, reading along with Penny from what I thought was a trigonometry book. My throat felt better, but the cold air didn't help much. I made it to the second floor landing. This wasn't like the bullshit motel doors. It was solid. This was why I always did my homework first. Luck was on my side. Earlier, when Penny had been warming up soup, I'd seen that only one of the deadbolts was locked. I could have made it through two, but it would have put more strain on my shoulder. I pulled the angled crowbar from my pants, and with a good push that made my shoulder click, I got the door open. It was way quieter than I would have thought. She never looked up from her figures. As soon as I was in, I listened for a full minute. It sounded clear. Knowing the layout, I went down the hall. I'd been down it with Penny so many times that I knew to step around the middle of the floorboard beneath the "Hang in there" cat poster to avoid the squeak and the hardwood. Feeling intense cramps, I made it into her room, and as she sat there, I viewed what she saw and the back of her head at the same time. Even knowing it was a risk, I had to do it. I had to view her seeing me as the knife came. Knowing it would give her a chance to react, I got within a foot and said with a still squeaky voice, "Hello, Penny." I felt her panic as she spun around, and then her terror as she saw the knife, while viewing myself the whole time. It reminded me of the double vision I used to get when my old man would crack me in the back of the head with the shovel handle, except the images weren't duplicates. I could feel her resignation as she accepted her fate. Quickly, her fear and anger disappeared. There was just emptiness as she finally let go of the dream of her better after-college life that she'd worked so hard to get. When the knife went into her eye, I instantly knew what a mistake I'd made. As it struck the skull, I lost sight in my eye and dropped to my knees in pain. Maybe I just had to wait until her heart stopped. Then I would be all right. A minute went by. No change. Then a few more. In agony, I felt for her pulse. I knew I didn't have to. She was gone. Yet I felt for her pulse anyway. There was nothing there. "Father, that was over a month ago. That's why I'm here now. I never believed in the church, and I'll be honest, at this point, why not? I probably still don't, but I can't think of anyone else to ask. How much longer is it until a dead person is truly gone? You see, I never would have believed it, the same way most wouldn't believe in my viewings, but after death, there is consciousness and pain. Every day, I can still feel her lying in the darkness of her casket, wishing she could leave."
You've been listening to Tendencies by Jason Fisher. Jason Fisher is a horror and crime author specializing in anthologies. When not writing, you can find Jason biking the trails around his home, playing with his nephews, adding to his VHS collection, or on the deck feeding the deer and enjoying nature. Now, in my opinion, this is a damn good horror story. Simple premise, lots of room to explore the repercussions, and a twist at the end that I honestly did not see coming. Oh, and peppered with murder, sex, and a trail of breadcrumbs leading straight into the DSM-5. Jason, my hat goes off to you. And if you fine listeners want to read more of Jason's work, go pick up his collection, Your Place Is Here Now, over at Velux Books. I hope you all enjoyed tonight's story, and thanks, as always, for joining me on the old Horror Hill. I'll be back with a glistening fresh episode next week, and I hope to see you there. In the meantime, I'll be putting masking tape over all of the gadgets in my house, both digital and analog. Until then, friends, stay spooky. You've been listening to the Horror Hill Podcast, a production of Chilling Entertainment and the creative team at Chilling Tales for Dark Nights. Tonight's episode was hosted, narrated, scored, and finalized by yours truly, Eric Peabody. Additional music by Nikki McSorley. Got a terrifying tale of your own that you'd like performed? Email it to us at submissions@simplyscarypodcast.com to have your work considered for future production. Note that any writing utilizing artificial intelligence is ineligible. If you enjoyed tonight's episode, why not help us spread our dark presence online? You can follow Chilling Tales for Dark Nights on social media, and upvote, subscribe, and hit the bell notification icon if you're listening to this on YouTube. It helps us out a lot, and also keeps you up to date on new episodes.
If you'd like access to uninterrupted horror, free of ads and these annoying bookend segments, might I recommend signing up to be a patron? You'll get access to hundreds of episodes of this show, as well as everything from the other programs in the Chilling Tales for Dark Nights cabal. That means all of Scary Stories Told in the Dark, Drew Blood's Dark Tales, and more. It's a veritable smorgasbord of horrific delights. Head to chillingtalesfordarknights.com to get started. If you're looking for someone to narrate or handle audio production for your own personal project, I just so happen to know a guy. Email me at ericpeabodyvoice@gmail.com. That's ericpeabodyvoice@gmail.com, and we can talk details. If darkness is what you're after, listener, your search is over. Yet, let it be known, you haven't found the darkness. The darkness has found you.
Here's golf legend John Daly.
Hell yeah, these wins are piling up faster than my divorces.
I only spent on Moto, America's social casino. You know I've won a couple of majors. And on Moto, I've won majors, grands, and epic jackpots on their classic Vegas slots with huge, huge bonus rounds. Moto Casino adds new games and awards players free coins every single day. Grip it and spin it on Moto Casino.
Download the Moto Casino app today.
Moto Casino is a social casino. Void where prohibited. No purchase necessary. Visit Moto.us for more details.
Moto Casino. America's social casino.